I've said many times on this show, I love to hear first-person stories. I love to hear stories about people involved in a process of making something work. My next guest is just one of those people. His name is Phil Dusenberry. He is the former chairman of BBDO North America, which was one of the largest advertising agencies in the world. If you've ever seen commercials for Pepsi or FedEx or Frito-Lay or so many other different products, Phil was probably involved in the creative process that brought that to your ears and eyes at some point. He has written about his life in advertising in a new book called Then We Set His Hair on Fire, Insights and Accidents from a Hall of Fame Career in Advertising. Phil, welcome to the Paul Harris Show.
Well, thank you. It's very nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
The title of the book obviously comes from the Michael Jackson Pepsi ad in which his hair caught on fire, which was, what, about 15, 20 years ago?
That's correct. And it happened. It was an accident that possibly couldn't have been avoided if we had taken certain precautions. But at the time, who knew? And it was the final shot, the final take on the last day of shooting, and there was some pyrotechnics involved, and one spark caught on Michael's hair, and up his hair went in flames, and it was front page news on every newspaper in the world the next day, and turned into one of the most eagerly awaited commercials of all time as a result.
Yeah, Pepsi probably got more free media and free advertising by not showing the commercial than they did by showing it. Was that your idea to hold it back?
Well, no, we had planned to hold it back anyway because we wanted to premiere it on the Grammy Awards, and so there was a big, bit of a time span between the accident and the time it actually went on the air, and that was sort of scheduled anyway, but it turned out to be very propitious because it built the anticipation.
Was he a pain to work with?
Actually not. He was great to work with. He's a tremendous talent. And surprisingly, a very good business guy who really sort of knew what it was he wanted to do, and he was very cooperative. At times, his biggest problem, honestly, was being late to the set. He would come in about an hour late every day, and we sort of adjusted our schedule just to accommodate that. But I would say he was really good to work with.
But was he always surrounded by an entourage of people who would handle stuff for him? I would bet that it would be almost impossible to talk directly to him without going through 11 other people.
Actually not. He didn't mind talking directly with you as long as you were the one and not 10 people coming at him all at once. If you had a spokesperson, and in this particular case it happened to be me, then it was no problem and we got along just fine.
There, you tell the story in the book, and I'd like you to share it with my listeners, that people think that that was the worst thing that happened that day, but there was actually something worse moments before that with his glove.
Yeah, yes, indeed. Moments before we were about to, set our cameras and do a major shot, Michael, who you recall, wore this $10,000 bejeweled glove, and that was part of his uniform, and he never went on without it. And moments before we were to do this take, he went to the bathroom, and moments later we heard this shriek, and we had no idea what had happened, and we come running into the bathroom, and he had accidentally dropped his glove into the toilet. And here we are now, three or four of us, trying to fish his glove out of the toilet. Beyond the call of duty. And the funny thing was, moments later, when we were out there shooting the next shot, he was blowing kisses to the kids in the audience with his jeweled glove. I thought that was very funny.
The one that had been in the toilet.
If only they had known.
Oh, man. Now, let's talk seriously for just a second. Pepsi is probably one of your biggest clients through all the years. You were with them for over three decades, right?
That's correct.
Why is Pepsi still number two if you're so good?
Well, I tell you, when we started on Pepsi many, many years ago, Pepsi was a distant number two. And over the years, we've brought Pepsi up to within shooting range of Coke. And if you look at the supermarket sales and sales in stores of what we call choice, where the customer actually has a choice, Pepsi is neck and neck with Coke in those stores. Where Coke has the advantage is essentially in the fast food places like McDonald's and Burger King and stuff like that. But we have brought Pepsi from a distant number two to a very close number two all through those years of Pepsi Generation advertising.
Pepsi Generation and the Pepsi Challenge, which I recall actually walking into in a store maybe 20 years ago, and there was somebody standing there with a two-liter bottle of Pepsi and a two-liter bottle of Coke, and I said, what the heck is this? And they said, well, we're kind of doing a taste test here. And they didn't say they were with Pepsi. They just said, take the challenge.
Right.
And here's a little cup of one, and here's a cup of the other, and just tell us which one you liked. And I tasted it, and I preferred the Pepsi then, and as I do to this day. And I'm not saying that just to suck up. I'm just desperately hoping for endorsement dollars myself. But I asked the person in the store, what's the response been? And she said, oh, it's probably been about 2-1 in favor of Pepsi. Now, obviously, you can turn that into a marketing campaign, but first, somebody has to have the idea to have that woman standing in that supermarket. How does that happen?
Well, it really came out of a research study, because Pepsi really wanted to know how people felt about Pepsi versus Coke. And they did this massive study throughout the nation, and out of that research came the fact that Pepsi nationwide, more people prefer the taste of Pepsi over Coke. And so we all said, you know, there's a possibility for a terrific tactical campaign, and it was only meant to be a very tactical, very short-term campaign, just enough to really attract your attention. It was in and out, and it was mainly designed to run in those low-volume markets where Pepsi was a real distant second. In this particular case, it was in Dallas, Texas, and lo and behold, it really caught on. And suddenly, what was going to be a 5-week campaign became a 5-year campaign. And Pepsi started really closing the gap between themselves and Coke. And that's how the Pepsi Challenge was so successful.
Does research play a huge part in every advertising campaign?
It plays a role in more campaigns than you might think, but not in every single one. And the good thing about Pepsi and clients like GE and FedEx as well is that these folks go more on their gut instincts and their intuition rather than resting on hardcore research numbers. But everybody has to pay attention to what the numbers are saying, and how you read the research and how you analyze it is crucial to mounting a wonderful advertising campaign.
I've always had a theory about research, particularly when it comes to new products, and you're an expert on this, so you're the perfect person to ask. I think that if you want to introduce a new product to the market, research is not going to be all that valuable, because when you ask people what they want, they only know what's been there before. And, you know, for instance, if Apple had asked people, would you like to have something that gives you music that you can listen to on headphones and you can carry around, people would have said, okay, well, we know the Sony Walkman and all those other portable devices that have been there, and there wouldn't have been the enthusiasm that there turned out to be for the Apple iPod if they had gone that route. Or
exactly
am I misguided?
Right. Exactly right. Because consumers, as you say, will only play back to you what they think, A, you want to hear, or B, what they've heard in advertising and from their own knowledge. So we came up with a system called the Problem Detection Study, which goes out and asks the consumer to complain about something. You know, complain about it, because consumers are great at complaining. And that's when they really get it off their chest, and that's when they really tell you candidly and honestly what's on their minds. And out of that can come a great solution for an advertising campaign.
So, for instance, for the iPod, people might have been saying, you know, I can't carry around all my music with me, and I wish there were some way to do that.
Exactly, exactly.
And have there been times where you and your colleagues at the ad agency have come up with a campaign, and that inspired a client to develop something new in that way?
Well, actually, we did more than that. We actually had a test kitchen at BBDO, our agency, and we would devise meals and soups for our client, Campbell's Soup. And we came up with a soup that had lots of big, chunky vegetables in it, and meat and stuff that was hugely popular with the kids at the agency. And we went to Campbell's and said, you know, this is a soup that eats like a meal. And it was the birth of chunky soup for Campbell's. And that's how that came to be born.
It's Paul Harris here on News Talk 1120 KMOX, talking with Phil Duzenberry, the former chairman of BBDO North America. His book is almost like a primer on how to do advertising by being creative, and I hate this expression, but it fits here, thinking out of the box. The book is called Then We Set His Hair on Fire. Are there ads that other people did that you said when you saw them, oh, I wish we'd thought of that?
Yes, indeed. Over the years, you know, you've seen advertising that our competition has done, and you say, my goodness, boy, that's great. I wish I had done that. The Nike advertising is a perfect example. The Apple advertising, when Apple launched their Macintosh advertising in 1984 with a commercial that was sort of the shot heard around the world, we all look at that with awe and envy and said, boy, we wish we had done that.
Now, that commercial aired during the Super Bowl.
It did.
Which, was that the beginning of the, quote, Super Bowl of advertising, or had it been around before that?
That was really the inauguration of the big, entertaining, dramatic commercial vehicles that would run on the Super Bowl then and from then on. And that commercial was the one that really led the way.
And do clients come to you and say, we have to be on the Super Bowl, or do you go to them and say, we have to be on the Super Bowl?
It's sort of a mutual thing sometimes. I mean, mostly I would say, is instigated by the client who says, you know, I really want to get out there in a big, splashy way, and I have to believe the Super Bowl is the way to go. And indeed, we would say it is the way to go. And we probably have placed more clients on the Super Bowl than any other agency in the country. I mean, we one game I remember a few games back, we had 30% of every of all the commercials that ran in the game, which is huge.
Wow. And conversely, have you had clients who said, we want to be on the Super Bowl, and you said, no, you shouldn't be on the Super Bowl?
That's right, because A, they either couldn't afford it, or B, they didn't have the right, you have to have the right kind of a product to be on the Super Bowl. If you have a product that requires a lot of explanation, a lot of hard sell, save your money, because people want to be entertained that day. They want to see something that's fun and funny and light and humorous. They don't want to have something that's, serious and something that's going to really make them have to think too hard, because it's the kind of day they want to see the new entertaining stuff. And you got to have a product that fits that mode. Otherwise, I would say save your money and spend it somewhere else.
And there have been too many of those commercials that have missed the mark and have been wasted money at the Super Bowl, right?
Absolutely. And it's a big waste of $2.4 million per 30-second spot. It's a lot of dough.
I got to go back to soft drinks for just a second here and ask you, why did Coca-Cola stumble so much when they brought out New Coke?
Well, the reason they stumbled was, they knew at that point in time that Pepsi was making tremendous inroads and incursions into their share of market and into their share of volume. And they knew that Pepsi perhaps tasted a little bit sweeter than Coke, and they decided to come up with a product that somehow matched or tried to match what Pepsi was doing. And they tested it among consumers, and consumers really liked it. Consumers said, hey, you know, I really like this product. But the big mistake, the big faux pas, the thing that made this the marketing bungle of all time, was they tested the product without the Coke name on it. And suddenly, out comes this new product, and people said, holy cow, they changed my Coca-Cola, without letting them know in the test that it was going to be the new Coke. They did it in a blind taste test, and people said, I like the taste, but they didn't like the fact they didn't know it was going to be the Coca-Cola replacing their Coke.
Could they have succeeded if they had called it something else?
I think so. I think it was a good product that they came up with, and if they had given it, let it be a brand extension, a line extension of their brand, it might have succeeded.
Phil, of all the guests I've ever had on here, I know you may be the first who won't mind that I had to break for commercials.
Okay.
Stand by. We'll come back and talk some more. Phil Duzenberry's book is a great read. It's called Then We Set His Hair on Fire, Insights and Accidents from a Hall of Fame Career in Advertising. It's the Paul Harris Show on News Talk 1120 KMOX. It's the Paul Harris Show, rolling through another afternoon here in the Bi-State area and talking with Phil Duzenberry. He was the chairman of BBDO North America, one of the largest advertising agencies in the world for several decades, and is still affiliated with them, writing about some of his history in a book called Then We Set His Hair on Fire, Insights and Accidents from the Hall of Fame Career in Advertising. What was an accident in your Hall of Fame career, Phil?
Well, aside from the the Michael Jackson hair burning.
Yep.
I don't know if you call this an accident exactly, but what had happened was we had signed Madonna to do a Pepsi spot, and it turned out to be a lovely commercial. It premiered on the Bill Cosby Show, got a wonderful reaction. The very next day, unknown to us, Madonna released a video using the same song that she had used in our commercial, released a video which had a lot of very controversial images in it, images that some people felt were somewhat sacrilegious or blasphemous or tasteless and offensive. And as a result, people started confusing that video with our commercial. And people started to think that that video was, in fact, the Pepsi spot with Madonna. And we had to really pull the spot off the air. We had to lick our wounds. We had to pay her the money that she was contracted for. And we just had to walk away. And it was one of those tragic events that you learn from. And the learning you learn that you get here is simply when you work with celebrities, there is a risk. There's a risk. You never know what's going to happen. There may be something that ends up in the newspapers or an event such as the one I just described, but it's one of the risks that you have to accept when you work with a celebrity.
Speaking of celebrities, supermodel Kate Moss is in a little bit of trouble now because she admitted using cocaine after some British tabloids wrote about it, and then she acknowledged it a couple of days ago. Now she's been dropped by a big fashion retailer in Europe and by the Burberry and the Chanel people. Would you drop somebody from an advertising campaign for admitting that?
Well, to be honest with you, I mean, it may sound prudish or fuddy-duddy, but I would have to say yes. I think you don't want to be associated. You don't want your brand or your client's brand to be associated with anything like that because, you know, it really comes back and will bite you. And you have to be careful not to let your brand get tarred with that kind of a brush.
Why is so much attention paid to younger Americans? We always hear about youth demographics when people my age in their late 40s and up into their 50s, 60s, even 70s, we're the ones who actually have the money. Why is so much attention paid to people? You know, my daughter's 11 years old. It seems like everything's targeted at her instead of me.
Well, it's a strange phenomenon, but to be honest, I really think the advertising that's targeted at young people is really advertising for products that are essentially the kinds of products that young people consume, like soft drinks, like potato chips, movies, records, things of that sort. They are the big spenders in those categories. Pizza, fast food, it's all about the kids. And not just 11-year-old kids, that's a little young, but when you get up into the teenage years and the early 20s, there is the lion's share of the spending right there. But you're right. Older people, people in their 40s and 50s, have tremendous disposable income, and yet I think a lot of advertisers sort of get their head stuck in the sand and don't realize that there is a tremendous amount of potential in those older folks.
Yeah, particularly as the baby boom comes to closer and closer to retirement age, doesn't mean that once people stop working that they're not going to be spending.
Exactly right. And I think a lot of brands, a lot of companies, a lot of products want to be associated with a more youthful side of America. They want to feel like they're part of youth, part of something young and vibrant, and not, you know, old and sort of feeble.
You mentioned that you wouldn't keep Kate Moss on if she admitted she used drugs. Have you ever had an advertiser that came to you and said, "Phil, I want you guys to come up with a campaign for us," and you looked at their product and you said, "No, I don't want to be associated with that"?
Well, I think in the past, you know, we've had the opportunity to work on some cigarette advertising, which we passed on because we just felt it was not the right thing to do. There have been products that we felt were inferior and really couldn't live up to the promise that the advertising might make. Those are very few and very rare, few and far between and very rare. But occasionally you do stumble across something like that, and you just have to say, "Look, thank you very much, but no thanks."
You actually worked on an anti-smoking campaign that was pretty successful, didn't you?
Well, our agency in London really did that, and they worked on. They had the insight to come up with what it was that was going to really make an anti-smoking campaign take off, and they were aiming it at young women because they felt that there was a tremendous opportunity there, and discovered that the thing that the women, and again, this is where research came into play, discovered that the thing, women didn't want to have happen was anything that might hurt their looks. And so out of that research came a campaign that said, look, you're going to be hurting your looks if you continue to smoke. It's going to make your eyes crinkly and your skin wrinkly and so on. And it became a very successful anti-smoking campaign in the UK.
Talk about recognizing the bullseye and then hitting it.
I mean, that's right.
That's a classic example right there. Have you ever done a campaign, shown it to the decision maker, the CEO, or whoever it was, and had them reject it completely and say, this is not what we want to do with our product at all?
Well, you know, you go through the ranks of a client organization when you do an advertising campaign, and the bigger the company, the more levels of approval that you're liable to run into. You have brand managers, assistant brand managers, marketing directors, advertising directors, and finally you get to the CEO, because every CEO is going to want to see a major new ad campaign that's going out with their brand on it. And the worst thing that can happen is for that CEO to look at that advertising and say, you know, this isn't what we want to say about ourselves.
Yeah.
I mean, oh, you're dead right there, first of all. And you've gone through 6 months of development through people who are well-meaning, who felt it was the right thing to do, and yet the CEO says, I don't want to do that. That's not what I want to say about us. And then the name of the game in terms of the moral of that story is simply try to get to the top guy as quickly as you can, because he can make or break your campaign and make or break that approval process.
All right, then I got to ask the converse. Have you had situations where you had something and everybody at the lower levels thought it was great, and the medium levels thought it was great, and the bigger levels thought it was great, and then you brought it to the CEO, and the CEO said, I don't get this?
It has happened. It happens on very rare occasions, because I happen to have had very good relationships with the top guys, the CEOs, the Jack Welch's of the world, the GE, Roger Rico, CEO at PepsiCo. And when you have those relationships, you can begin to, in effect, we'll say, grease the skids. You can begin to sort of drop hints along the way as to what kind of a campaign you're working on, and you get a sense whether or not they're going to really buy into that. So when you finally show it to them, you kind of know they're going to go for it.
Phil worked on a classic piece of television advertising after 9/11 to get New York back into everybody's consciousness in a positive way. I'll have him tell that story in just a moment from his book. Then We Set His Hair on Fire, Insights and Accidents from a Hall of Fame Career in Advertising. Phil Dusenberry here on the Paul Harris Show on News Talk 1120 KMOX. Here's the Miami Vice theme, which probably brings back bad memories for my guest, Phil Dusenberry, former chairman of BBDO North America, one of the world's largest advertising agencies, who I guess it's safe to say from reading your book that you had the misfortune of working with Don Johnson on one of your Pepsi commercials, Phil.
Yes, that's true. It wasn't one of our most pleasant experiences working with Don. We did a commercial with he and Glenn Frey of the Eagles. And for Pepsi, and it's a long story, probably too long to tell here, but he was not great to work with. He was not my favorite celebrity, let's put it that way.
He was a real prima donna.
A little bit of a prima donna, that's for sure.
Now, speaking of celebrities, you did something so terrific after 9/11, and you involved a bunch of celebrities. I think it started with you having lunch with then-Mayor Rudolph Giuliani.
That's correct. The city was in the doldrums. Hotels were empty. Restaurants were empty. Theaters were empty. The city was down on itself. Everybody was moping around, and I found myself having a meeting with Mayor Giuliani and asking us to do an advertising campaign to get people back in the boat. And I said to him, look, this sounds crazy, but maybe we should do something that's upbeat and humorous. And he said, you know, that would be really terrific. And I got our team together. And within 2 days, we had our campaign nailed down and went down to City Hall and presented it. We got celebrities like Henry Kissinger to run the bases at Yankee Stadium, and Barbara Walters trying out for a Broadway show, and Robert De Niro and Billy Crystal acting in a Thanksgiving Day parade. And we got all these great celebrities who worked for nothing and gave all their time and talent and energies, and it was a wonderful smash success. And it got people really to, you know, look back in New York again as a place to visit and business started picking up, and it was just a wonderful success story all around.
And like so many other success stories in your career, it also launched a lot of free media, because the TV news outlets looked at this and said, hey, you know what? This is part of the post 9/11 story.
That's right, and we got a lot of free TV time, not only in the U.S., but actually in Europe, in France, and Japan. They ran this thing as part of a news, as a news item, and it was just great.
Turning to something else, in all these years that you've been doing commercials and print advertising and all of these things that you've been involved in, is it safe to say that if you come up with the right slogan, you're going to change the fortunes of a company if you get it just right?
I think so. I think you can really, make a difference with a great phrase, the sum up tagline, as we put it, at the end of a commercial, because it sums up everything that commercial has been trying to say, and it's a line that, if it's really terrific, can be so memorable, becomes really indelibly etched in the minds and memories of the American buying public. And boy, when you got that going for you, that's a major plus.
What were some of yours?
I wrote, "We bring good things to life for GE." I've written, there's so many. I wrote "The Choice of a New Generation" for Pepsi. Making it great for Pizza Hut. It's just sort of a long list of things that, advertising is never done in solitude. It's never done by one person. I always like to think that it's a collaborative effort, and it's two or three people in a room just talking about ideas, and out of that discussion comes a wonderful idea that's going to really make some client very happy and make an advertising campaign really great.
Yeah, but I also know, having done a little bit of writing and creating myself, that you don't come up with "We bring good things to life" the first time. There are a lot of rejected slogans that fall by the wayside, and lots of sleepless nights going, well, that's not right, what are we going to do?
The night before we came up with that, before I wrote that line, we had another phrase, which was, "We make the things that make life good." And I looked at that line and I said, oh no, this is horrible, this is like a line out of a memo. And that's when I went home that night and came up with "We Bring Good Things to Life" for GE, and it won us the business, and it ran for 24 years, which is probably one of the longest-lasting theme lines around.
That's terrific. The book is called "Then We Set His Hair on Fire, Insights and Accidents from a Hall of Fame Career in Advertising." Phil, thanks for your time today. I appreciate it.
By the way, one last thing, if I have two more
you do.
Seconds
Go
to
ahead.
Say. You asked me work I was envious of.
Yes.
This is not a kiss up to St. Louis, but I got to say, a lot of the Budweiser work that's been done over the years has been fabulous, and I wish I had done it.
A lot of that Super Bowl ad time that you didn't buy up, they bought up.
And
did some pretty good work with. You're absolutely right.
That's true.
Thanks, Phil.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Phil Dusenberry, former chairman of BBDO North America. The book should be on every advertising agency's shelf and should be read by everybody who wants to get into that business, because it is an absolute primer on the world of advertising. It's the Paul Harris Show on News Talk 1120 KMOX.